Okay, it's 9 o'clock. Without further ado, let us begin. We started last class with Rabbi Eliezer Berkovitz, who you see his picture here. I will erase that now. We only got to about 5 minutes, so we're going to spend the rest of this class and also next class on him. I just want to respond to a few comments and some emails. Some of you might remember David Silberberg, who listens to the show, not usually live with us. He sent me this very interesting proof that I told you about, quoting Rabbi Soloveitchik from his book, The Lord is Righteous, in which he mentions that there's no reference to the Western Wall, the Kotel, in classic rabbinic literature. And there's a midrash that mentions it. He thinks that's a later interpolation. And David pointed out that find plenty of references to the Western Wall in the Zohar. In fact, it's a central theme. And Rav Soloveitchik knew the Zohar very well, so it must be that he did not regard the Zohar as being a Tanaitic work. With reference to this, I just found that in the Radbaz, his responsum, number 688, he also mentions this Haggadah that says that the Shekhinah will never leave from the Western Wall, and he can't believe that it means the Kotel Maravi, the Western Wall, because he says that it's full of Tumat HaGoyim, that is, the non-Jews are in control of it there, and they have their mosque and all this stuff, and therefore it can't mean that. It must mean, when it speaks about the Western Wall, it must mean the Western part of the world, Maravo Shel Olam. With regard to the Brisker method, I meant to mention this, but I forgot. We spoke about this book in the past, Mishnat HaNazir of the Nazir. We are dealing with original intent. I just want to read you something that the Nazir wrote in his diary. He studied in Sabatka, and he mentions that he visited Rav Rinus. Rav Rinus, in his works of Agadah, had all sorts of amazing things, amazing conclusions he derived from the Agadah. So he asked Rav Rinus, are all the wonderful Rayonot HaChadashim, the new ideas you come get out of Agadah, are they really true? That is, Lahem Kivnu HaChachamim, that is, the sages actually intended this. And Rav Rinus replied, Im HaRayonot Nachonim Hu HaIkar, that it doesn't really matter what the sages thought. If the ideas that we derive from this are correct, that's enough. We don't have to say that the sages actually thought of everything we develop. And we spoke about this with regard to the Brisker. And then he says that he asked the Rosh Hashiva, Rav Moshe Mordechai Epstein, if the Svarot, that is, if his ideas, if his analysis that he puts forth, that he shows, he explains the Halachot, his Svarot, if they're true, that is, if the sages intended this. And Rav Moshe Mordechai replied, Im HaSvarot Nechonot Zeho Ikar. That as long as the ideas, the analysis, the explanations make sense, that's enough. That's all you need to worry about. Whether the Rambam actually intended this or not, that's not what's important. But if our explanations can better explain the Rambam, that's enough. But then the Nazir says, however, my understanding is that according to the way of learning, Halimud Hamiti, that the Svarot and the Rayonot and the ideas have to be those that they have to reflect original intent, that the rabbis, the Baalei Halacha and Agadah, actually had to have this in mind. So we see a great dispute deal with put forth ideas. Rav Lichtenstein has a long essay on this. Do we need to be concerned that what we say is really what the sages had in mind or not? If I'm a bit choppy, Bill, I don't know what to do. I'm unplugged in. Maybe you're wireless. I don't know if anyone else is choppy. Let me know. It refers to the Western Wall of the. They're referring to the Kotel, which is not the Western Wall of the Mikdash, because that's not standing. So how could they say that the Western Wall? You know, the Shekhinah is always with the Western Wall. It's referring to the retaining wall. Tech support, if you can maybe get to work on this and see what's doing with the choppiness, I'll speak a little slower. In case that, if it's choppy, maybe you won't miss as many words. It's referring to the retaining wall. There were people, by the way, David, who didn't know. They thought that this western wall that we go and visit was not the retaining wall holding up the mountain. They thought that this was actual the wall of the Beis Hamikdash, and that there were people who had the practice of not putting kvitlach, not even touching the wall, because they were impure. But now we know what the situation is. There's no question what the western wall is. Well, I'm glad to see if the sound is good in Tokyo, then the problem is not with me. One of you asked me, I was speaking last week about the idea of Bittel and Rav Henkin's position that we follow the Rashba if we can, that if they're making the food and they put it in as a matter of course, we don't rely on Bittel, on nullification. I don't know how far even Rav Henkin would follow this. For example, Rav Moshe Feinstein, in his famous response about liquor, assumes that you can bittul, and he doesn't say that when Rabbi Teitz wrote to him about making kosher liquor that wouldn't be kept in these cases that held the wine. And Rabbi Teitz, I forgot the name of what he called it, but he was going to make a killing, because if he got Rav Moshe to declare that all whiskey is non-kosher, and that you need a hashgacha, Rabbi Teitz was there with his brand to become a millionaire. And Rav Moshe, though, doesn't go and say that you have to buy it with hashgacha, even though Rabbi Teitz was going to provide it. Rav Moshe simply said that it's bottle. But Rav Moshe does say in one of his tshuvot is that you cannot give a hashgacha on a product and rely on bittul. When I said that is an argument, whether you put it in as a matter of course, whether you can still eat it, and that most people say you can, but the Rashba says you can't. I'm not referring to, obviously, if Jews do it. A Jew can never put in non-kosher and expect for it to be bottle, nullified. But if the non-Jew is doing it, then it's the question, does it have to fall in by accident, or can he do it as a matter of course? And Rav Moshe says that if you're giving a hashgacha to the product, his understanding is then you're somehow involved in the production because you're involved in giving with the company, and therefore you don't give a hashgacha if it's bottle. But even that, I don't think, is 100%, because I know there are times that the OU will give a hashgacha on things which are bottle. I guess it depends on the circumstances, but as a general rule, you don't give a hashgacha. Now, in terms of the rules about chametz are also the same rules. A lot of people assume, incorrectly, that if you have some chametz in a product, that you can't eat it on Pesach. And they remember from what they learned in yeshiva, in their youth, maybe not in their youth, that smallest amount of chametz, no matter how much it is, makes something no good and it can't be eaten. But that only applies on Pesach, that if it's during Pesach, if the chametz falls in, even if it's a tiny drop, what we call a mashahu, then you can't eat it. But if it falls in by accident before Pesach, and it's less than the 60th, you can eat it on Pesach, and this is the old Machokes, that's the Rashba's opinion. According to the other opinion, even if the non-Jew puts it in as a matter of course, it's part of the product, then you can eat it. And the same issue, I guess, is with kidneyos as well, although there are some who probably think you can debuttle something with kidneyos before Pesach automatically, if you want. I believe there are some who say that. But it's the same issue with kidneyos. Certainly you can I believe it's machokes about kidneyos situation is. In general, kidneyos is not batal b'shishim. Kidneyos is batal b'rov, even if it falls in on Pesach, the majority. Let's see what Bill says here. He was talking about that. Well, even then, we say with regard to wine that it's nullified in one out of six. So thank you for the corrections. Why are derivatives of kidneyos usser? Well, first of all, you mean according to those who say it's usser? It's a good question. None of these. Take Coca-Cola for example. Let's assume for now that you hold that kidneyos derivatives are forbidden. So corn syrup. Why should kidneyos derivatives, though, in Coke be a problem? Because it's certainly less than 160. It's less than one and a half. It's not only 160, it's less than one half. That's all you need. So if you hold that, if it's part of the regular production, that it can be bato, even if they put it no matter what, and in certain kidney ulcers, only a min hug, then there should be no problem whatsoever having Coke. It's definitely bato, the corn syrup. However, this goes back to the idea, which can be traced to the Rashba, that if you're giving hashkacha on it, and truthfully, even if you weren't giving hashkacha, even if the Coke was just producing itself on its own, I think today people are very machmir. And they'll say, don't eat it, no matter what, because they're putting it in as a matter of course. But matter, it's less than 60. But today we have hashkacha, so and some people like regular Coke more than others. I mean, the Pesach Coke more than others. Two more things. I want to make a correction of what I said. I wasn't sure when I mentioned about women saying Kaddish. I thought that it was the Chavot Yair who permitted it. Actually, Chavos Yair of Yar Chaim Bacharach mentions that in Amsterdam they permitted a woman to say Kaddish. And the Chavos Yair, that is the rabbis, permitted it. And the Chavos Yair disagrees, and he says that this goes against the custom, and therefore it'll weaken the Jewish custom. So therefore he says... it's not, you shouldn't do that. And I mentioned, though, that with regard to that, Reb Henkin's position, that in any event, people like the Chavos Yair, they're speaking about where one person says Kaddish, not where a lot of people say Kaddish. And finally, one thing I want to show you, it comes from this book. A new book just came out called Vayichtov Mordechai. It's just a collection of letters of rabbis. And this relates to what we spoke about, how, despite what Rav Moshe Feinstein says, many other poskim, and we'll see today as well, see it very difficult to void a marriage through what we say mekach taot, that is a false purchase, a false kinyan. That is, when you get married, the woman did not know something about the man, so she wouldn't have agreed to be married. Rav Chaim Kanevsky, last week, his picture with the holy wine, but a great poskim in the Haredi world, he was asked as follows. If it was not known before the marriage that the man was an androgynous, that is androgynous, not doesn't have normal sexual organs, well, achar akidushin, after the marriage, it was became known, obviously, and this is a mekach taos, it's a false factual agreement here, it's not a valid marriage, you would think. Does the woman need a get or not? Moshe Feinstein will just say, obviously, she doesn't. He explains the whole purpose of marriage is family life. This is what Rav Chaim Kanevsky says. Ein mukharach shezeh mekach taos. It's not so clear that this is a mekach taos. That is, I guess his logic is a woman would prefer to be married even to such a person. I can't imagine how one could come to this conclusion. It's not just empirically false, but it goes against such basic... notions of what people want out of marriage, but that's what he says. Okay, let us continue. Let's see what. Yeah, we spoke about this last week, Bill. Not only do we say Rav Moshe mentions, not just he mentions in Russia seeing it. Rav Henkin mentions, Rav Soloveitchik testifies to women saying Kaddish in Vilna. I brought other testimony that Rav Chaim Moshe Grzinski permitted women to say Kaddish, and this was done in the Koy, and the Rav Soloveitchik mentioned the Koys of the Vilna Gaon. So this isn't some newfound practice of Rabbi Avi Weiss or anything like that. This is and Rav Aaron Soloveitchik obviously permitted women to say Kaddish, but this goes back to Russia. So it is hardly something new, and goes back to the traditionalist poskim. It could be that in a traditional environment where there's no feminist issues at all, this is not an issue at all, not a concern at all. So a woman says Kaddish, but when you're in an era with lots of feminism, you'll have right-wing, let's say modern Orthodox rabbis who'll say women can't say Kaddish. We heard an example of that last week because they're afraid of what it's going to lead to. But in a different circumstance where there's no feminism, it's no big deal. In the traditional Sephardic world, it was very common for women to walk into the men's shul and say Birkas HaGomel. I don't think your typical modern Orthodox shul, even the Haredi shul, would allow a woman to walk into the men's section and then say HaGomel after giving birth or something like that. But in a traditional environment, that wasn't a problem. That wasn't an issue. Now, we ended last class. I mentioned Rav Eliezer Berkovitz comes to Berlin. To Berlin to study at the Berlin Rabbinical Seminary, and I said this was not uncommon. Plenty of students from Eastern Europe and from Hungary wanted to come to Berlin First of all, they wanted to get a secular education, and if you go to Berlin today, anyone can go. There's a youth hostel, a kosher hostel, and a little restaurant where the old rabbinical seminary was, and you'll see it's right down the street from the University of Berlin. The way it worked is that you went to the seminary in the morning to early afternoon, then you could go to the university in the afternoon, and you would come back at night to the seminary so you can get a secular education. And I mentioned that the problem was that many people showed up and they just showed up in Berlin and they didn't have high school diplomas, the equivalent of high school diplomas. So they couldn't go to the they couldn't be accepted. The Rabbinical Seminary in Berlin, like YU today, did not accept someone if they didn't have a college education, I mean, high school education. Okay, Menachem, that's interesting you pointed out, although I've never seen that. If you could find a source for that, I'll think very good. Yes, Rabbi Dovi, Rabbi Ovadia Yosef, this was in the news a few weeks ago that he said that women could say Kaddish. Although he said before, you know, about women saying Birkas HaGomel. It's not a Kiddush at all, women saying Kaddish. With the post-scheme, but Rabbi Ovadia Yosef, they made a big deal about it in Israel. I don't know what the practice is in Israel when he came out and said that women could say Kaddish. In my book, incidentally, on Rabbi Yaakov Weinberg, you can see a picture of Berkowitz at the Rabbinical Seminary. Now, also, many of these people came to Germany because they wanted to get, as I said, they wanted to study, but it wasn't just study like our university. Go to university to receive a doctorate. In Germany, you didn't have, like we have today, you get a BA and then get a doctorate. Why did they want a doctorate? So they can get a job, not just in Germany. You could go back to Hungary, you could get a job in an enlightened Orthodox community, or even in Eastern Europe. There were many places that wanted to get a rabbi doctor, and many of these people wanted to come to America. And being a rabbi doctor, they knew would help them. At least in those days, it would help them. I think today, maybe having a rabbi doctor, it would hurt you. You have to hide your doctorate. But in those days, it was a big help. Now, while at the rabbinical seminary, Berkowitz becomes very close to Weinberg. And I think it's correct to say that he was his leading student. I heard from Rabbi Apfel, the Dayan of Leeds, passed away some years ago, that often the shiur at the seminary became a back and forth between Berkowitz and Weinberg. It was going over everyone else's head. And this admiration that Berkowitz had for Weinberg would continue to the end of Weinberg's life, and Weinberg would share this admiration for Berkowitz, as we'll see. And at the same time that he was there, as was the standard view, contrary to what's often said, it was not obligatory to get a doctorate while you were at the Berlin University. No one forced you to get a doctorate. However, since most of these rabbis wanted to get jobs in Germany, almost all of them did get doctorates because they basically needed a doctorate to get any sort of decent rabbinic position in Germany. But there were some who didn't get doctorates. So he was studying at the University of Berlin. Now, if you try to find his doctorate, if you go to the University of Berlin website, and look in the library catalog under Eliezer Berkowitz, you won't find anything. However, if you look under Ladislaus Berkowitz, there you will find his doctorate. I've never seen it, but it's titled Hume und der Deismus, that is Hume and Deism. So Berkowitz, we see, not just got a doctorate, but a doctorate in philosophy. After receiving smicha, he serves as a rav in Berlin from 1934 to 1939. Don't know anything significant about his time, those 5 years there. He does tell us in his book, Not in Heaven, he describes one event that took place in Berlin. This is on pages 104 to 105. And the sensitivity he shows there, much in evidence in his later years. He describes a case where a woman was married to this man, and then after they got married, she finds out that he had syphilis. And a few years, how they find this out? Because the man, it began attacking his brain, and he became insane. And the woman wanted to get divorced. The problem was the man was insane. That is, he wasn't of the mental capacity to issue the get. So and it says that she went from rabbi to rabbi in Berlin, and no one would touch the case. Finally, someone suggested she come to Berkowitz, and he says, I was then the youngest rabbi serving the Jewish community, still in my 20s. The first question I asked myself was, is the halachic concept of incompetence due to insanity identical with the medical definition of it? He says that he visited the man in the hospital there in the insane asylum, and he concluded that the man was capable of giving a get, and he wrote a responsum on this. he gave it to Rabbi Yaakov Weinberg, and this is published in the Sridi Yesh, and Rabbi Moser Grzynski agreed with this responsum. But then he continues that he was never able to bring the matter to a successful conclusion because the husband understood what a get was so well that he refused to cooperate. He says, possibly this difficulty could have been overcome, although every visit to the asylum under the Nazis and prior to the age of tranquilizers was a rather disconcerting experience. The technical difficulties were insurmountable, so I felt. One would have to bring to the asylum a sofer to write the authorization, to receive the authorization to write the get, direct from the mouth of the husband. In addition, two witnesses would have had to be present, and another person would have to be authorized by the husband to act on his behalf to give the hand the get to his wife. I felt unable to move the Nazi hospital authorities' help in this matter. And then he continues to say that eventually he leaves Germany, but what becomes of the poor woman and her child? He says, had I, in those early years of my rabbinical career, had the experience and halachic understanding I was able to acquire later, I would have made the case of annulling the marriage retroactively because the husband had failed to inform her about the state of his health. It would have been relatively easy in the prevailing conditions to give the ruling a solid halachic foundation. And these are the sorts of questions that Moshe Feinstein would permit all the time. In 1939, he leaves Berlin and goes to England. Now, the significance of this for 20th century Orthodox intellectual history is very significant, because before he goes, and I heard this from his mouth, the only time I ever spoke to him when I went to Israel, it was in 1988, and I wanted to interview him about Rabbi Yaakov Weinberg, and the event I'm talking about now is described in the Sridi Yesh, but he gave me more details. Berkowitz comes to Weinberg in 1939 before he's going to leave. I think it was March, although it could have been February. It's after Kristallnacht. And he says to Weinberg, he sees all these papers on Weinberg's desk, stacks of papers, and he says to him, why don't you give them to me? I'll make sure they get out of Germany. And he took them with him. And these make up the first three volumes, much of the first three volumes, of the Sridi Yesh, Weinberg's volumes of responsa. Weinberg, when he was forced to leave Germany, hundreds of other responsa and letters were lost. He had, I think it's two or three, I forget now, books already completed, three books already completed, which were lost. He had a volume on Talmud, on the sermons, and he had his doctoral dissertation. I think he might have even had something on the Mishnah. Many articles ready, all lost. Had he not given them to Berkowitz, he would have been missing a great deal in Orthodox history. Now, when Berkowitz comes to London, he takes them with him everywhere he travels, everywhere he goes, that all his new apartments, wherever he has to live, and then the Blitz starts. And he took them, every time he went down to the underground, he took the papers with him downstairs. Therefore, no matter what would happen upstairs, they would be safe. Weinberg's other close friend, Samuel Atlas, was not so lucky. He was also in London, and he went down to the underground, though he left his papers upstairs in his apartment, and the building was hit, and it started a fire, and most of what he had was destroyed. So we owe Berkowitz a great deal of thanks. Berkowitz described this to me when I spoke to him. In 1940, he begins serving as a rabbi in Leeds. Leeds, industrial town, industrial city, I don't know, maybe by car, what, 3 or 4 miles north of London. That's where Rabbi Apfel later becomes rabbi. We've spoken about Leeds in previous classes because Rabbi Deiches was rabbi in Leeds. Rabbi Yoel Herzog, the rabbi, father of Rabbi Chief Rabbi Herzog, was in Leeds. So we've spoken about it. And again, from 1940 to 1946, there really isn't anything of significance in Berkowitz's career. He is not writing important books or articles. If I came to you in 1945 and I mentioned the name Eliezer Berkowitz, so you would expect him to become, I mean, he is, you expect him to remain a rabbi, a rav. I don't think anyone would expect him to become a great Jewish philosopher. From Leeds, he travels to Sydney, Australia, serves for 4 years, and then to Boston. He serves as a rabbi from 1950 to 1958. He was serving together in Boston with Rabbi Soloveitchik. One would have expected them, perhaps, to come to a very close relationship in the same town, both coming from Germany with doctorates, with similar views of the world. That's not the case at all. Rabbi Soloveitchik never mentions Berkovitz. As far as I know, he never mentions Rabbi Soloveitchik. And you have people like Emanuel Rachman, who also are very liberal in their halachic views, who were very close to Rabbi Soloveitchik. In the latest Modern Judaism, Lawrence Kaplan has an essay on this topic. Despite Rabbi Soloveitchik's public approach of Rabbi Rachman in 1975, in the years before then, they were very close. Confidants, you could even say. Rabbi Soloveitchik sent unpublished responses to Berkovitz. And even after 75, as far as I know, the relationship was not a bad relationship. I asked Berkovitz's son, though, Avrami Berkovitz. He teaches at the University of Haifa. He's a physicist. Actually, he might teach at Technion. I'm not sure. I think it's Haifa, though. Your father was there in Boston for 8 years. What was his relationship with Rabbi Soloveitchik like? This is a quote from his letter. Marginal, to say the least. Dad Zatzal thought that Rabbi Soloveitchik Zatzal was not forceful enough in developing solutions for the halachic problems of the modern community. However, he did send Dov. Dov is another one of his sons, to him at YU. And he goes on to talk about that a little bit. So no relationship with Rabbi Soloveitchik. In 1956, Berkovitz publishes his first significant work. And it was in Boston that he really begins publications, and then it continues. First important work is called Judaism, Fossil or Ferment. What does that mean, Judaism, Fossil or Ferment? Let's close this up thing. Well, he had published before that, but not important stuff. In 1938, he publishes a small German book about the Talmud. And in 1943, he publishes a book called Towards Historic Judaism. This book has some interesting things to say, but it doesn't give any real sense of the significance of Berkovitz that he will later assume. But with Judaism, Fossil or Ferment, he moves from speaking to the Jewish world. He had published some articles, a couple small books, but now he's speaking to the world as a whole. It's really his first significant book. What does the title refer to when I say Fossil Ferment? The title refers to Arnold Toynbee, who was a great British historian who wrote a multi-volume history of civilization. Now, Toynbee was apparently infected with the genteel British anti-Semitism that was found in much of the upper-crust British society. In fact, Toynbee in 1936 actually visits Hitler and describes this visit. He worked in the British Foreign Office, where his job was dealt with the Palestine Mandate. That also could turn you perhaps against Jews. Jews want their own state, and British don't want to give it to them. He had also studied Arabic. He knew no Hebrew, so he was a typical British Arabist type of personality. And in his book, multi-volume work on history, he refers to Judaism as a fossil. So that's what Berkovitz is referring to when he says fossil ferment. Now, Toynbee would later change his views. He later developed a much more positive view, or sympathetic view, I should say, to Judaism. And this really was in large measure due to a correspondence he had with Rabbi Jacob Agus. Jacob Agus comes out of Yeshiva College, graduate of Reitz. In fact, not only graduate of Reitz, Talmud Muvhak of Rav Moshe Soloveitchik. Later becomes one of the leaders in the conservative movement, co-authors of the conservative responsum permitting driving to shul on Shabbos. So the three, you have Jacob Agus, you have Theodore Friedman, also from Orthodox family, and then you have the other rabbi who I can't remember, whose father was the Rosh Hashiva Tiferes Yerushalayim, drowned swimming. We spoke about him. He's swimming off Coney Island. And then his Ramosha then becomes Rosh Hashiva, and this was the son who was killed. He was the one who was killed. We spoke about all this. He was killed in Michigan, in Detroit, in the synagogue, where the person gets up during the middle of the davening, the bar mitzvah, and shoots him. But Jacob Agus, he's not only though a conservative figure, he becomes very close to Mordechai Kaplan. And I guess you could say he's a Reconstructionist, but until Mordechai Kaplan creates his own movement, Reconstructionism was part of conservative Judaism. He taught there and had many followers there. So he has a correspondence with Toynbee, and this leads to an 11th volume of his writing called Reconsiderations. And in there, he has reconsiderations about Judaism. Now, Berkowitz had also published a response to Toynbee that appeared in Judaism, Judaism, and then later a book. And his complete response, as I said, is this book. The Talmudic learning at the Hildesheimer Seminary was very strong to get smicha. There were people there who never graduated. They were given a sort of, let's say you stayed there for 4 years, and you weren't able to pass, you were given like a reverend certificate. But those who got smicha there were really Talmidei Chachamim, not of the level of Eastern Europe where we're dealing with people who sat for 10 years. But to give you an idea, everyone who finished the rabbinical seminary had to write, part of their smicha was to write a responsa, three responsa. On Orachai, on Yardea, Evan Ha'ezer, and Choshen Mishpat. And they were given a case, and they had to write a responsa. I don't think that the YU graduate, maybe they could, but I don't think the typical Yeshiva University Musmach given could really write a responsum, an original responsum. When I say original, I don't just mean you open up the Abi Omer of Avad Yosef and it's like this Rav and that Rav and give a conclusion. I don't think the typical YU Musmach could write an original responsum. So I think we're dealing with a higher level than what's given out, let's say, at YU, and obviously much higher than what's given out at YCT, but not at the level, of course, of the East European yeshiva. But I think you'd have to agree that in terms of Western Europe, this was the highest level smicha, higher than Rietz, to get the smicha. And that's my sense, at least. Rietz has obviously changed also. The smicha today is much more formal. You take written exams. There was a time to, I think, perhaps even into the 70s. I don't know if someone could correct me. We have Musmachim from YU, but certainly in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, when it was time to get smicha, you came in and you were with Rabbi Soloveitchik and Dr. Belkin and the Lam Sharav before that, and you sat there for grueling, could go on for hours and hours, oral exam, and sometimes you have to come back for a second oral exam. So I don't know, but in terms of today, if you're comparing it today, the rabbinical seminary was on a higher level than what you have. I mean, if you look man for man, graduate the Musmachim and Rabbinical Seminary, almost all of them really at a level, and some of them are really fine Talmidei Chachamim. Some go even higher, but really fine Talmidei Chachamim to a much higher percentage. When you think of, for example, the Rietz graduates that you put in that category, most of them are at YU or Rosh Yeshiva, either in America or Israel. But in terms of it's just regular rabbis, that you find rabbanim in Germany, seminary graduates writing responsa. And we don't have that in America. We don't have rabbis, musmachim, really writing halachic responsa in the traditional fashion. So that's my sense, at least. That was the thing. You're right. In Tunisia, the big thing is about they give them. What Dovi Hoffman says about Tunisian way, it's in Rietz, I mean, in the seminary, they'd give it at the end. However, if you study at the Tunisian yeshiva today, for example, Bnei Brak, Kisei Rachamim, it's part of your normal study. It's not just when it's time for smicha, but as part of your normal training in learning, you're given questions and you write responsa, and then the Rosh Yeshiva, their job is to correct the responsa, not just to correct them in terms of content, but also style, to teach you that you can have the ability, develop the ability to write good responsa, halachic responsa, which means proper use of sources, proper citations, and a high level of Hebrew, melitza, and things of that nature. Returning to Berkowitz, why does Berkowitz feel it's important? Write a response to Toynbee. And it's not just Berkowitz, it's not just Agus. Toynbee, an article came out about this a couple years ago. Toynbee actually had three great debates with Jewish figures. One of them was with Yaakov Herzog, the son of Chief Rabbi Herzog in Canada. And these were huge events, the debates over Zionism. You have to recall that Toynbee was an internationally known historian, but much more than that. He was the Doris Kearns Goodwin David McCulloch of his time. He was the most popular and influential historian of his day for the masses, not for the academy necessarily, but for the masses. Very few historians cross over into the general world. If you're lucky, and your books then start becoming bestsellers on the New York Times list, you've done it. But most historians, we sell 1,000 or 2,000 books, and we're happy. Toynbee was one of those who got to have his book become a bestseller. About historians who are bestsellers, we also have to put the Israeli ambassador, Michael Oren, in that category. His book on Israel and the Middle East was on the bestseller list for a while. Just to give you an example of this, here's a picture. Toynbee makes the front cover of Time magazine in 1947, dealing with a very influential personality. So what do you do then when you have the world's most influential historian portraying Judaism in less than a good light? It's no wonder that many people wanted to refute him. Here is how Berkowitz describes Toynbee's work at the very beginning of his book. Quote, "Probably the most significant aspect of a study of history is that it is not at all a historical work, that is, one belonging to the discipline of the science of history. It is a philosophical and theological inquiry concerning a great deal of historical raw material." By the way, one other point. I could read to you from Berkowitz's writings in 1943, London, and he Jason Leeds, and he wrote his other work. And he also writes a very good English. These people like Berkowitz were geniuses. They show up in a place like England, and within a couple of years, they're able to write the King's English. I don't know how many people could be like that. What's Toynbee's big problem with Judaism? Well, first of all, he sees it. Judaism comes to an end, his conception, with the rise of Christianity. That's why it's a fossil. It served its purpose. It no longer has any role to play. That was the classic Christian view. Judaism no longer has any significance. When we say we're like a fossil, it's something just hanging on, but doesn't have anything really to offer anymore. It shouldn't really be here anymore. It's just it's a vestige of the past, which happens to remain. That's it. Now, we don't need to go into the great details of the dispute anymore. It's a big deal at its time. Today, I think for most people, it's Toynbee that's the fossil, not Judaism, and certainly not Berkowitz. But I will say that one of the things Berkowitz focuses on is the contrast Toynbee makes between Judaism and Christianity. Christianity is the peaceful religion. Judaism, on the other hand, he sees as the religion of violence. It's the old canard, the old caricature of Judaism of the Old Testament. Obviously, the Old Testament is different than the New Testament, and the peace in the sense that Jesus describes it is not to be found in the Old Testament. On the other hand, the idea that Judaism doesn't recognize peace and it's all about a vengeful God is as much as a caricature as you can get. And Berkowitz was obviously quick to point out that look at the history of Christianity. Despite what Jesus says about turning the other cheek, it's been 2,000 years of violence and bloodshed in Christendom. But Berkowitz focused on this contrast, and he points out that when Toynbee speaks about Judaism, who does he refer to? He speaks about the Zealots. He speaks about the Maccabees. And that's all that Judaism is for Toynbee. Then, of course, he sees the modern-day state of Israel, which he sees as a revival of this. And Berkowitz says, what about the Talmud? If you want to know where the Jewish ethos is, it's not with the Zealots. It's not even with the Maccabees. That's one event. That was an event that took place at a certain time for a specific purpose. But that's not what defines Judaism. We're not a warlike people. You have to look in the Talmud. You have to look at the Siddur. If you want to know where Jewish values are found, look in the prayer book. Look in the liturgy. That's where you find the Jewish ethos. Yes, what you say, Rodney, about I knew Alexander Altman. Alexander Altman comes in 1938, October 38. I interviewed him a few times, and he comes to Manchester. Also a student of Rabbi Chaim of Weinberg, a philosopher, and one who was a rabbi in Berlin. a lot of similarities. Leo Jung also. Berkowitz says, quote, this is page 42, the friendliest thing one may say about him, that is Toynbee, is that he is an ignoramus. Why is Toynbee an ignoramus? At Toynbee, just looked at the Ethics of the Fathers, which are available in English. They've been available in English for a long time. In fact, two translations in English were done by Christian scholars, both of whom were Philo-Semites. One was R. Travers Herford, who was a scholar of Second Temple Judaism and wrote, I think you can probably get it on Google Books, a wonderful translation and commentary on the Ethics of the Fathers, historical commentary. And the other was Canon Danby, Herbert Danby, from Oxford, an Episcopalian priest, who wrote a complete translation of the Mishnah. You can get it, you can still buy it, it's about this thick. When you think that a non-Jewish professor, a scholar of Hebrew, was able to translate Shisha Sidre Mishnah, a fine translation, and this is not someone who spent any time in yeshivas, it's an incredible achievement. It's one thing to translate Avos. So R. Travers Herford, I mean, he had knowledge of Hebrew. And if you have basic knowledge of Hebrew, go to any Israeli, they can translate Pirkei Avos. So there might be some words you don't know, so you can look in the Bartanura. However, take it to a typical secular Israeli, give him Tractate Me'ilah. I mentioned Me'ilah because I'm doing that tractate right now. We had this, I mentioned last class, this terrible tragedy in West Aron, so we're splitting up the entire Tanakh and the entire Shisha Sidrei Mishnah to finish it before the Shloshim is over, and I picked Me'ilah. Unfortunately, I picked Me'ilah. You give it to someone who doesn't, a secular person, or someone who doesn't have, give it to someone even traditional Jewish education, but it's not that learned. Give him Tractate Me'ilah. Give him Hura. Give him Baba Metzia. They won't be able to make heads or tails of it. And here you have a non-Jewish scholar who is translating the whole Mishnah. And then he goes on and he translates in the Yale Judaica Press Mishnah Torah. For many years, the only translation of the Mishnah Torah into English was that done by Yale Judaica Press. Now we have, I think it's complete, this new edition that's been coming out the last 10 years, Rabbi Tuger of Chabad, big brown volumes published by Moznaim with a nice commentary. I think they've completed the whole Mishnah Torah. For some reason, Artsfeld never wanted to do the Mishnah Torah. But until then, recently, the only edition was the Yale Judaica Press, which isn't complete, by the way. Everything but Sefer Mada. Sefer Ava was done by Professor Kellner a few years before that, and the other volumes were done in the 50s and 60s. But Canon Danby did one of the volumes. So Berkowitz says, had he simply looked at Ethics of the Fathers, he would have seen that Judaism is very different than the way he describes it. The greatest of Jewish thinkers who are seen in Ethics of the Fathers, they're not teaching, and they're teaching the same time as the Zealots, they're not teaching the message of the Zealots. He would have seen, for example, Simon the Just saying that the world is based on three things: Torah, prayer, and deeds of loving kindness. Nothing in Christianity is greater than that. Nothing in Christianity, none of their values are more significant and more important and more ethical, you could say, than what Simon the Just says, that the world is based on Torah, prayer, and deeds of loving kindness. Berkowitz also points to something that I think it's very true, although maybe an academic like Berkowitz, he was a rabbi at the time, but speaking in an academic vein could say it. I wonder if you get up in your local shul and say it, how many people will be willing to accept it. But it is true. He says that Toynbee covers up the fact that the teachings of Jesus and Paul that he's so in love with are actually Jewish teachings. And what Berkowitz is saying is that all the significant teachings of Jesus are really Jewish teachings. Now, that's probably a bit of an exaggeration. The Sermon on the Mount, Turn the Other Cheek, I think there's things in there where say they're not Jewish teachings. But maybe not. Maybe I'm wrong about that. There certainly have been great rabbis who argued that, like the Rambam says, that be the one who's insulted rather than insult. And you find great rabbis who say, turn the other cheek. That is, not that it's an obligation, but it's a pious thing to do. You don't need to respond in kind. hard to know whether Jesus actually, when he said turn the other cheek, he was referring to governments. The traditional interpretation of Christians is that he was referring to individuals, not governments. Governments need to establish order. You can't have a situation where a government says you can attack my citizens and I'm not going to do anything. So it could be that all the teachings of Jesus come out of a Jewish background, and that's possible. But Berkovitz's big point is that everything talks about Christianity is really Judaism. If he just was willing to open his mind, he would see that. So, for example, when Paul speaks about the real war that we're involved, not the physical war, but the war, the struggle to lead a just life, as war being transformed from a physical struggle to a spiritual struggle, that's good Jewish teaching. You even find this in the Chovos HaLevavos. But he's referring to the Talmudic period. If you look at the rabbis and you look at their ethics and their morality, it's obvious that from their standpoint, the struggle, the real war, is an inner war. Rabbis of the Talmud were not interested in going to war and killing and fighting. Truthfully, as Berkowitz points out, that's what Christians did. They were interested in fighting a different war, a war to be just, a war to be moral. And Berkowitz has very little patience because, first of all, combined with his anti-Christianity, which I think we'll get back to later, he had a deep hatred of Christianity, I think even an unfair hatred of Christianity. He goes overboard in his criticisms of Christianity, but tied into the fact that he sees Toynbee really putting forth a terrible caricature of Judaism, where he doesn't even, it's not that he puts forth the bad of Judaism and the good, he doesn't even recognize that there is any good, so Berkowitz really goes to town on him. Yeah, but I wouldn't believe that there ever was such a thing as a priest who shots Baal Peh. You raise a good point, though. Is this a wisdom or is this Torah? It's an old debate. The Abarbanel thought that you could get Torah from non-Jews. He cites Christian thinkers. Rav Haigaon has a response in which he talks about how he didn't know the meaning of a word, so he went to ask the Syriac, he asked one of his students to go ask the local Syriac priest or bishop to help him, and the student was reluctant, and he said, go ask him. And, of course, the Rambam thinks you can learn Torah, because metaphysics is Torah, it's the highest Torah. We can learn that from Aristotle. But the other tradition has been, and on the contrary, if they tell you that there's wisdom among the nations, believe it, but don't believe that there's Torah among the nations. And therefore, it doesn't make any sense, and we never would learn from the non-Jews when it comes to Torah. And if they do say something, it's not going to be right. The Rambam would say that, yes, it's not that they're teaching us Torah per se, they're teaching us things which, from our standpoint, are Torah, but maybe they don't look at it as Torah. Or even the Rambam might say he doesn't accept that teaching. Because in a sense, Aristotle, you know, this is Torah, and so I think he just might not accept that. This goes back to the dispute of the Sonsino books of the Bible. The Sonsino books of the Bible, if you look in the introduction, look at Hertz's introduction to his Chumash, he says that he believes in the notion of accept the truth, whoever says it, and therefore he's going to cite non-Jewish thinkers. Today, if you look at the Sonsino books of the Bible, they've been redone. So they no longer cite the non-Jewish authorities. It's the old debate. Can we learn stuff relevant to Torah from non-Jews or not? Yeah, it could mean, good point, Bill, it could mean sock, not knowledge, or it could mean knowledge. And that position might not be the position, that might be intention, the idea that non-Jews don't have Torah, might be in tension with the position of accept the truth, whoever says it. Or it could be that non-Jews don't have Torah in the sense as a living document, a document that guides their life. When it says don't believe that they have Torah, that is that they're guided by Torah. But in terms of pure intellectual understanding, a non-Jew could point something out also. And he doesn't get the mitzvah of Limud Torah or anything like that, but in terms of the fact, he knows it. That's valuable. The same debate applies to the using the works of non-Orthodox thinkers. I wrote about this in my Lieberman booklet. Do you take the right, let's say Louis Ginsburg. Let's say Louis Ginsburg has a great interpretation, or Gershom Scholem has a great interpretation in a religious work, not an academic work, but in a religious work, do you cite it? Some think you do cite it, and it's valuable to cite it. Others think you don't cite it. Others think you cite it, but you don't say who you cite it from, because that's their punishment. Because they're not observant, we take their good stuff, but we don't mention them. And there's actually a proof for this, because Tosus mentions that the Acher, I was Acher, Elisha ben Avuya, he was punished for becoming a heretic, that his teachings would be cited, but not in his name. So that's a good proof that even the heretics have good teachings, although maybe we don't attribute it to them. Okay, before we go on, what does Rodney say here? I find it hard. It sounds to Rodney like it's above Misa. By the way, the only Aramaic translation, it's not of three tractates, it's of, or five or some, it's of the entire Yerushalmi, was Jacob Neusner. Jacob Neusner, say what you will, it's quite incredible. Actually, no, he didn't do it all, Jacob Neusner. He did the Bavli. He did the whole Bavli himself. When it came to the Yerushalmi, he divided it up. Half the volumes he gave to other people. So, for example, Stuart Miller from University of Connecticut, who I grew up with, he had one tractate, and all these people each got one tractate. And Neusner got the other tractates, and he did them. Paul Lieberman said that this translation was worthy of the wastebasket. It was a worthless translation, but it's a translation. So I don't think that the Gera Rebbe would, or anyone, would assume that Jacob Neusner's translation would give them any answers to any problems, because Jacob Neusner knew more than the Gera Rebbe. However, Shaul Lieberman commentaries on three tractates, Yerushalmi Kipshuto, and anyone who looks at Shaul Lieberman's work, including the Gera Rebbe, see that many problems are explained. Now, the Gera Hasidim today are coming out with a new commentary on the Yerushalmi, because they started this movement to do Daf Yomi with Yerushalmi. They use Lieberman. I mentioned this in my Lieberman booklet. They use Lieberman's writings, but they won't mention him by name. And Art Scroll used Rabbi Gorin. Rabbi Shlomo Gorin has a commentary on Jerusalem Talmud Tractate Berachos. And I know for a fact, because I know someone who works at Art Scroll, that they used that. They had a copy of it, but they won't mention Rabbi Gorin by name. They don't approve was. Having said that, I should mention that I have it on good authority. Experts in Yerushalmi, their Rav Gorin's translation, large measure is actually, I don't know if you want to call it plagiarism, but it's makes unacknowledged use of Ginsburg's four volumes of Perushim Vechidushim on Jerusalem Talmud Brachos. Let us go on. I don't want to spend any more time on the Toynbee criticism. Anyone who's interested, if you go to Google Books, you can find Berkovitz's attack, complete volume. His attack on Toynbee is on Google Books. It's still interesting. It shows it's structured as a polemic, but there's more to it than that. In 1958, Berkovitz is appointed chairman. He knows he leaves. Wasn't in Brooklyn, he was in Dorchester. He leaves Boston and moves to Chicago, where he's appointed chairman of the Department of Jewish Philosophy at the Hebrew Theological College in Chicago. Today we know it as Skokie Yeshiva. And today it's just a regular yeshiva, but it was a very different place. We're going to talk a bit about the development of Skokie and the yeshiva, because Berkovitz's career is tied up with that. But it's when he's in Skokie that he's finally able to devote himself from 1958 on to teaching and writing, and it's now that he begins to develop an international reputation. In the next few years, his books, a few books appear. One, God, Man, and History. I have a cover title page here. Here it is. That appears. In addition to that, he has a book on prayer, published by Yeshiva University Press. He also publishes what he calls a Jewish critique of the philosophy of Martin Buber, also published by Yeshiva University. Yeshiva University published a number of books, about 100, 150 pages in those days. Published Rachman, they were going to publish Roy Soloveitchik as well. He was also teaching philosophy at Hebrew Theological College. He was not teaching Talmud. Skokie did not allow him to teach Talmud. He would have liked to, but Talmud was kept, Talmud instruction was kept for the traditional Lithuanian Talmudists. And Skokie Yeshiva always had top Lithuanian Talmudists in it. They wanted to bring over Weinberg after World War II. Weinberg was reluctant to go because he felt that he had to be the senior teacher. He said it's not about his own honor, it's the honor of his students, but he said that to go there and not be the senior teacher, and he wouldn't have been. They had Chaim Zimmerman and later Kreisworth. He wouldn't have been the senior teacher, and he said that that would not be kavod, coming from where he was a senior person at the Rabbinical Seminary, so he didn't go there. But they always had great Lithuanian Torah scholars there. So he wasn't teaching Talmud or Halacha, but he was thinking about it, writing about it, giving interviews about it. And some of his ideas were quite radical for his time. But why were they radical? Well, first of all, he was speaking about changes in the Halacha, speaking about how Halacha can't be frozen. That's code word, can't be frozen. It means let's get Halacha moving again. The idea being that there's a lot of things we can do in Halacha, but we're not doing it because the rabbis are afraid. The rabbis don't have the courage. And Berkovitz is talking about how Jewish law was not meant to be frozen. This is the sort of language that for many raised the specter of conservative Judaism. He wasn't yet publishing on this topic in a scholarly way, but he was publishing in newspapers and giving interviews. Only in the 1970s does he begin to write scholarly articles, even books, on this topic, as we'll see. It became a matter of contention in Skokie. Here you have, Skokie was always very much a traditional yeshiva. It also had academic Jewish studies. Unlike today, you know, it had a real academic Jewish studies. You had great scholars who were there. But it was a traditional yeshiva, no different than Ritz, with great European Talmidei Chachamim. And here he had Berkovitz, putting forth radical ideas about how we have to, Jewish law was not meant to be frozen. One of the rabbis in Chicago wrote to Weinberg about this, wondering whether he should sever his relationship with Skokie. Weinberg is his Rebbe, so he's writing to him, and he tells him some of the radical stuff Berkovitz is saying. I published this letter in an early Adad journal. You can find it, a translation of it. Unfortunately, the top line is cut off, so we just have the copy of it. We don't know who it's addressed to, but I think it's addressed to Rabbi Ephraim Epstein. He was a leading rabbi in Chicago for many years, a friend of Weinberg from their youth in Slobodka. And I called this article Rabbi Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg on the Limits of Halachic Development, because that's really the issue Berkovitz is dealing with. And I'll speak for another couple of minutes. I just want to let you know, next class we'll look more in detail at this letter of Weinberg, what Berkovitz was doing, and then talk about the great dinner, the famous dinner that leads to the firing of Rabbi Chaim Zimmerman, publicly calls in front of all the students and other people Berkovitz a heretic for what he was saying and what happens. It was the talk of the Orthodox world for a few months. And then I will show you how different things are today. Skokie was willing to fire its Rosh Yeshiva to keep Berkovitz, and I'll tell you what they think about Berkovitz today, but we'll do that next class. But let me just speak for a couple more minutes. This rabbi writes to Weinberg about an article Berkovitz wrote, and I wasn't able to find the exact article. I did find interviews and other things that it could be, this is what he might be referring to, but what it was an early presentation of Berkovitz's liberal understanding of the halachic process, which then achieves full-blown elaboration in Not in Heaven, also in a Hebrew volume. Because Berkovitz was known as a leading disciple of Weinberg, it's only natural that he wrote to Weinberg. Weinberg says to this rabbi, first of all, he says, quote, I read the article you sent me and was greatly troubled. It's impossible to deny that this article contains harmful ideas that cannot be accepted. So we see already that Rabbi Berkovitz, Rabbi Weinberg, did not see eye to eye. In fact, in this book, Not in Heaven, which I'm going to devote a little time to, in the introduction, Berkovitz states, Let me make a personal confession. Well, all my life I have endeavored to take my stand on the foundations of Halachic Judaism as it was handed down to me in my father's house, and as I have acquired it from my studies in Yeshivot, and later from my great teacher, Rabbi Achir Yaakov Weinberg. In this, my work, I was determined to be guided exclusively by the traditional Halachic material as I found it, etc., etc. In other words, he tells you, don't think that I'm reflecting my teacher, Yaakov Weinberg. I studied with him. He's my Rebbe. But I'm coming to my own ideas. It's important to stress this, because there have been people who see Berkovitz's ideas and see them as a reflection or as an elaboration of what Rabbi Yaakov Weinberg held. And it's not true at all. We will see quite clearly where Berkovitz goes beyond where Rabbi Yaakov Weinberg was willing to. And we'll pick up on that next class. Let's see. Take some questions now. Oh, yeah. Larry, Berkovitz published a great deal in tradition. So he was in touch with Wurzberger, who was the editor of it, and Rackman. He was, I don't know how close he was to either of them. He was in Chicago, but he was definitely in communication with them. Rabbi Jung especially, as well as his class. He was published in tradition. Some of his most important pieces were in tradition. One of the pieces is we're going to speak about next class. His idea on form a new rabbinical seminary. He saw real problems with YU, with Reitz, and he puts forth how we can establish a modern rabbinical seminary, just like Berlin, in America. You'll see what he says about the Brisker method, all sorts of interesting things. He published his critique of Martin Buber, I think, or was it his critique of Mordechai Kaplan in tradition? A number of things there. He was very welcome in tradition. What I think is one of the themes, and when I deal with Manuel Rackman in a future class, you'll see one of the great themes is that how a man who was really modern Orthodox, in the center of modern Orthodoxy, the people who were attacking him were on the right wing, the Haredim, or on the right wing of modern Orthodoxy. He was very much in the center. By the end of his life, he was very much on the left. And that's a combination of both of Orthodoxy in America changing from the 50s to the 70s, changed a great deal. And also, as Orthodoxy itself moves right, and he sees himself being rejected, his ideas being rejected, he moves left. The parallel is exact to Rackman, and I was happy to see, I've been making this point for a long time, I was happy to see that Larry Kaplan in his new essay also makes the same connection to Berkovitz, that by the end of their lives, they in no sense could they be regarded as mainstream. They were very much on the left. Tell you some fascinating things about the synagogue, at least the synagogue that Rackman worked at, and how things have changed, and also what Skokie, how they view Berkovitz today, only do you, how they viewed him 20 years after his death. That we'll do that next class. I am unaware of any correspondence. You say track it down. I'm not sure what you mean by track it down, because I don't know that there was any correspondence. A reference to correspondence there? I don't know. Correspondence of Zimmerman and Lieberman you can find in the Lieberman archives, where Zimmerman writes to Lieberman telling him off. when Lamb was the first editor, then Wurzburg becomes it. When you say was it acceptable to tradition, of course it was acceptable, but all these people were acceptable. Rackman also was publishing. Some of Rackman's most important stuff was in tradition. Tradition was very different in those days. When you mentioned a rabbi, every time you mentioned him, you didn't have to put the R in front of his name. You never would have it was a philosophical type of journal. It was a reflection of Rabbi Soloveitchik and of intellectual orthodoxy. It was not focused on halacha. It was a very, look at the old issues. It wasn't like it is now. It wasn't like it became. So, of course, then Berkovitz was teaching. He was the most important thinker at the Hebrew Theological College. I think you can say that after Joseph Soloveitchik, Eliezer Berkovitz was the most important thinker in Orthodoxy in the 60s and in the 70s. And tradition was very happy and proud to have Berkovitz write essays for them. And we're going to, as I said, we're going to go through. The first thing we're going to do is look at his halachic vision, which was a failure. His halachic vision never took off, and we'll describe why. But then we're going to look at his theology. His theology was a great success. I first realized this, I think, when I was working at Brandeis University, and David Gottlieb from Or Sameach was coming to speak at Brandeis to recruit for Or Sameach, and I was there, the chaplain then there, so I had to drive him from Brookline to Newton, and I couldn't believe when he starts talking to me about the insights that he was getting from this book on from Eliezer Berkowitz. Because I thought Eliezer Berkowitz would be puzzle, and he was puzzle, obviously, but not his theological writings. His halakhic writings, yes. So the theological writings are very significant, and to this day, Berkowitz is regarded as one of the most important post-Holocaust theologians. And in the Orthodox world, he is without question the most important Holocaust theologian. Now look at him, what he has to say. Further here. Is it, Rodney, I'll take a look at it. Is he citing the translation, like you're saying? Because the only translation is Neusner. So I don't know. I know the book you're referring to by Zeltzer. I don't know, does he have a source for this, or is this just something he heard? I remember. I remember you talked about this. I contacted a person who was writing an article or a book on Chaim Zimmerman. He said he tried to get the letters, and I haven't heard from him. So apparently unsuccessful. Chaim Zimmerman, for those who don't know, was the nephew of Baruch Ber Leibowitz, the great prominence. And he's a musmach of Reitz. A genius. A genius of geniuses. But an eccentric fellow. The fact that no one today has heard of him also says something about orthodoxy. But incredible genius. But I will tell you a story next week about Chaim Zimmerman that you will never forget. Also, Chaim Zimmerman, they say he knew the Talmud by heart, but he wasn't a conventional person. He used to like to watch soccer on TV. He was a big soccer person. He didn't dress in black. He used to wear nice sports jackets, different colors. And I am told that he used to drive a convertible for Chaim Zimmerman. If you wanted, there's plenty of people who knew him well. The Frimmers in Israel, Dov and Aryeh Frimmer, were big students of Chaim Zimmerman. And they told me some stories about his memory, incredible memory. But he had a short temper also, or a short fuse. When he wrote things, he often wrote very sharply. He attacks Menachem Kasher on the International Dateline and really goes overboard. His attacks, he gets personal. He attacks other people as well. But, without question, a great genius. And he also had a doctorate. I don't know if it was a real doctorate or an honorary doctorate, but his English books he signs it Dr. Chaim Zimmerman, and he wrote English books, and he's quoting Bertrand Russell and Bergson. He was a genius of genius, but he never really made it. He went to Israel. He was a religious Zionist. That was a bit of a problem also. And he says to Rodney that he gave him a translation of the Yerushalmi. Yeah, he has a bill. He has a work on the International Dateline, but in that work, which is a defense of the Chazon Ish, if I'm not mistaken, it's really very sharp to Rav Kasher and really went overboard. But you get a sense of who he was, that he would speak this way. When I tell you the story next week about Eliezer Berkowitz, that was a sort of the type of personality that he could go off when he died. I believe it was in the early 90s. Yeah, the early 1980s, maybe it was. So one of my teachers told me that he went into, maybe it was the late 80s even, went into the shiur, and he said that a great man died today, Rav Chaim Zimmerman, and no one in the shiur had even heard. And these were guys in the 19, 20 years old, and they hadn't, none of them knew who Rav Chaim Zimmerman was. This is a person who was really a giant. Rav Moshe was, Rav Baruch Ber Leibowitz of Kamenetz, so the greatest student of Rav Chaim Soloveitchik. When Rav Chanan Wasserman comes to America, he refuses to step into the Yeshiva College, Yeshiva Shul Rav Chanan. And Dr. Revel sends Rav Chaim Zimmerman to Rav Chanan to try to convince him, because Rav Chaim Zimmerman knew Shas backwards and forwards, but it was unsuccessful. But they were successful in getting Rav Aaron Cutler to come give a shiur. Okay, I know what you're saying, Rodney. Okay. there is scholars, Peter Schaefer and others, they published in German translation the Yerushalmi. The Yerushalmi appeared in German translation, and it's all the different manuscripts. It's like four columns published by Leiden, Brill in Leiden. It's like $4 a volume. And they have all the different Gersaus there with a critical apparatus in German. And it's not just one scholar. You have a whole scholars. I mentioned Peter Schaefer in my Christmas Eve talk, but you have a whole scholars in German who are experts in Talmud, doing important work. And that's what he's referring to. Any other comments? Agan Sahad is the name of the book, Aleph Gimel Nun. You can get it probably on HebrewBooks.org. It's a very thick book. He also published in Hamaor, the journal. I think that's where he first published his attacks on Rav Kasher. Just to give you an example of what he says about Rav Kasher. Rav Kasher wrote a whole big book, Kafa Tarich. I think it's also on HebrewBooks.org, about the international dateline. And Zimmerman says that looking at Kasher, who was also not an analytical genius, but he, in terms of sheer knowledge, Kasher knew everything. Just look at Torah Shlema, he literally knew everything. But Zimmerman says that, he gives an example, he says, you have an ignorant person, someone doesn't know anything. And he sees the rabbi talking to someone who also doesn't know very much, but knows a little bit about Gemara. And the ignorant person there, you know, he sees them debating, you know, or talking about it, and he thinks that it's sort of an equal debate. He thinks that there's real issues on both sides. But of course, the person debating the rabbi doesn't know anything. He just knows a little bit of Talmud. And anyone who understands Talmud knows that this person also is an Am Aretz. And he says that's the same thing with Kasher. He says he writes hundreds of pages, and people don't know anything about the topic. They look at it, and they think he's a Talmud Chacham. But really, if you know about the topic, you know that there's nothing there, and it's all amaratzos. That's what he says about Rav Kasher. A little sense of who Rav Chaim Zimmerman was and the way he could write. I'll wait for one more minute. As I said, next week is the last class. We will not finish Eliezer Berkovitz this semester. We will deal with his halachic vision next class. And when we pick up after the semester, we'll have a chance to deal with his theology. I don't know. Maybe some of you will find his theology pretty basic. I think today it's pretty popular, some of the things he says, but it was significant when he wrote it. Okay, well then, let's call it a night, and we will meet next class, God willing, the last one before Pesach, next Monday night. Forward to seeing all of you here.